be honest with you this morning. I struggled with what to preach this morning. We've been going through a series. If you've been here the last few weeks, we've been going through a series on the Sermon on the Mount, the Ten Commandments, called More Than Fools, and we've been kind of going through step by step, looking at the Ten Commandments. And the next commandment that we were going to look at this morning was the sixth commandment: don't kill. And then on Wednesday, Hugh Hefner died. And I struggled with, do you even mention something like that? Because, quite honestly, he was not a man that many of us would think is worthy of much attention. But that happened, and then I started to see things popping up on news articles, things talked about, and talk show hosts mentioning this, and Facebook feeds and everything else. And I became kind of, quite honestly, frustrated about how he was being discussed. Here's a man who, for all intents and purposes, did much to destroy morality in our society. And yet what I was hearing from some of the things that were being said publicly about him was the man who did so much for our country to release us and our society from the moral chains that enslaved us. And it disgusted me. Here's a couple of things that I read. Maybe you read these too. Hugh Hefner was a giant in publishing, journalism, free speech, and civil rights. He was a true original, and he was my friend. Rest well, Hef. Rest in peace, Hef. Thank you for being a revolutionary and changing so many people's lives, especially mine. I hope I made you proud. A great man, entrepreneur, and innovator, your legacy lives on. F. And I struggled with, do we say anything at all? And as I reflected on that more, my frustration maybe came personally. As a young man in high school, I struggled with sexual temptation greatly. And while it wasn't solely Hugh Hefner's fault, I kind of looked to him as maybe one of the founding fathers of the movement that changed our society and led myself and many other young men and women to struggle in ways they maybe wouldn't have had to struggle and to the depths that they had to struggle. Eventually, I became free of some of the things that I struggled with in high school and college, but the toll on my life that it took and that struggle cost me dearly. And so maybe part of this is a little bit of frustration and anger at what this has done to our country. And the young men that I've worked with, the older men that I've worked with in my ministry, that this has affected, that this man has done so much for. And so when I found out that you had died this week, I couldn't help but reflect on the legacy that he leaves behind. So this morning's title, we're gonna do this morning. Maybe more so than just the sexual element of Hugh Hefner's legacy is thinking about our legacy. And when we die, what gets said of us? And so this morning, the title of the sermon is In Loving Memory, What Will We Leave Behind? If Hugh Hefner really attained every man's fantasy life, the man known to millions as simply as Hef was born on April 9th, 1926 in Chicago. He's the eldest of two sons, and this is largely from an article that I read getting some biographical information on him. He actually grew up, oddly enough, in a very strict religious household. He grew up Methodist, and his parents were strict Methodists. He would later reflect back on this point in his life with disdain. Said, part of the reason that I am who I am is my Puritan roots run deep. My folks are Puritan. My folks are prohibitionists. There was no drinking in my home, no discussion of sex. And I think I saw the hurtful and hypocritical side of that from early on. Hugh went to college, joined the Army, attended the Chicago Art Institute, graduated with at the University of Illinois with a degree in psychology, very educated person. And eventually wrote for a magazine called Esquire and left there after he didn't get a raise that he wanted. The decided to start his own publication, gathered some investors, and in 1953, December, launched Playboy magazine with $8,000 produced in his own kitchen. Without a date, because he wasn't sure if there ever would be another article or another magazine. And Marilyn Monroe famously graced the first cover article. It sold 50,000 copies, believe it or not, in 1953. For being an upstart magazine, it was a success, and so an empire was launched, and Hefner at the helm, who divorced his first wife, Mildred Williams, in 1959, was its charismatic, cosmopolitan head. Most pictures of Hugh are him in pajamas, some sort of silky smoking jacket, smoking pipe, and the images of someone who is a sophisticated man, a man-about-town type, somebody who is cultured and cosmopolitan and knew things about life, somebody that you should be wanting to be like. He was later quoted as saying, and you had to sum up the idea of Playboy is Puritanism. As the country's mood became more hedonistic in the 60s and 70s, Hugh seemed to ride this wave of revolution in our society. Asked by the New York Times in 92 of what he was most proudest, he responded that I changed the attitudes towards sex, that nice people can live together now, that I decontaminated the notion of premarital sex that gives me great satisfaction. The wild parties, the countless girlfriends and experiences at the Playboy Mansion certainly make for a wild tale, and there's lots that have been written on that. I don't dive into any of that because it's not necessary. But what troubled me most about Hugh's life and the things that have been said in the days since his death, it's been the fact that he's been lauded by these commentators as some sort of a civil rights activist, and he did much for civil rights. A champion of women's rights, and I'm not sure what kind of women's rights he was championing, but. And a benevolent philanthropist to charitable causes. But I guess the question that I asked this week as I was reflecting on all that he did and all that was being said about him was 50 to 100 years from now, 200 years from now, the history books being written about this country in this time, what will be written about Hugh Hefner? What will his legacy be like? And what will the things that he has done for our society and our culture truly be? Because there's a difference between what gets written about you in public circles and what actually happens in private lives. Sometimes what people say in a public setting is not quite true. And what happens in a private home as a result of something that has been done and a legacy that's been left might be somewhat different than what actually was said. And I began to reflect on another man, Solomon. Solomon, the famous king of Israel, seemed to have everything that you'd ever want. 1 Kings chapter 1 through 11 really tells the tale of this king. And we read from the beginning of his kingship, it seems like things are going great, and he starts out in such a godly mindset, desiring to do the right thing. In fact, so desiring to do the right thing that he begs God. He says, I don't know how to govern this people rightly. This is such a great burden. And begs God for help. In chapter 3, God grants him wisdom, the famous passage where God comes to him and appears to him and says, all the things that you would want, what could I grant you? And he asks for wisdom. And God gives him wisdom as well as riches. He became very, very wealthy. Chapter 10, verse 27 tells us that Solomon was so wealthy that silver was like stone. It was so common, it was like the stones that paved the streets. The man had chariots and horses and women and cities and land, servants, all the kinds of things that in his day and time would have made someone successful, made them want to be liked, made them want to be emulated and imitated in their lives. And in chapter 6, as a testament to his, at that time, devotion to his God, he builds the Temple of Solomon, a legendary thing, even in ancient history, as ancient historians count and read records of what this temple was like. It was a massive undertaking. He had cedar shipped in from up north. He had the best stone masons to cut the stones for this place. He overlaid everything with gold, and he made this incredible monument to the God that he loved and served, that his nation loved and his nation served. God appears to Solomon twice in his life, promising him wisdom in chapter 3, but also appearing to him again a second time in chapter 9, 1 Kings, promising him a throne over Israel forever. God was so pleased with how this man was following him with all of his heart that he says, if you continue this path, you will not cease to have a throne in your family over Israel forever. What a promise. What a promise. And then, of course, the famous visit in chapter 10 from the Queen of Sheba. And such a successful queen in her own right, she visits Solomon to try to understand this man, this wise person. And she heard all of these great things about him, but hadn't seen him for herself. And she travels from a great distance. Scholars still debate if it was Arabia or northern Africa that she comes from. But regardless, she travels miles and miles and miles. Several months' journey to come and visit with the king, Solomon. And she sits at his feet and he tells her everything that God has done for him and the wisdom that he's given him. But the tragedy occurs in the very next chapter, as the beginning of that chapter, chapter 11, starts out. That Solomon had married many foreign women who eventually turned his heart away from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In chapter 11, after 10 chapters of successful kingship, reigning, a godly man who wanted to do the right thing. In one chapter, it tells us the nosedive that became Solomon's kingship and monarchy. That he went from being the best of the best, the richest of the richest, the most wealthy and successful king that Israel would ever have, to building temples for his wives' gods, to then having rebellion in his own household and adversaries thrown against him, to at the end of the chapter his death and eventual division of the kingdom and the nation of Israel forever. The king who God had once promised, you will have a man from your family on the throne of Israel forever, now could be keep the kingdom together. And the book of Ecclesiastes, the passage that Phil read us this morning, such a telling tale of the aftermath of all of this, as Solomon reflects back at the end of his life, writes the book of Ecclesiastes, comes to his senses at the end of life, and understands just what his legacy is leaving. He begins the book, "Vanity of Vanities, all is vanity." He continues to describe in that chapter that we read this morning about all of the things that he pursued in life, all of the pleasures, all of the things that one could have in life, and that life could offer to someone. And he says, I got to the end of each one. I pursued wealth, and it didn't fill me. I pursued women, and it didn't fill me. I pursued wisdom, he even says, and it didn't fill me. All of it, at the end of the day, was meaningless. There is nothing new under the sun. That word for vanity is interesting. It's also the same word translated vapor in other places in the Hebrew. And throughout Ecclesiastes, Solomon laments his pursuit of pleasure and what it eventually costed him in the end. And in the end of the book, in chapter 12, as he kind of summarizes the message that he hopes to give people as he himself is aging and about to die, he says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Before you age, before things are too late, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. And he ends it much like he began, verse 8 of chapter 12. He repeats the phrase, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. 13 through 14 at the end of the chapter, the end of the book. He says, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring about every deed into judgment, every secret thing, whether good or evil. You think about what Solomon left. In the end, you have the gorgeous temple, but a morally bankrupt nation that will soon divide and begin a slow decline into eventual captivity for its wickedness. And even though at the end of his life, as he writes of Ecclesiastes, he begs people to listen to him, it doesn't speak louder than his life had. And the legacy that he leaves the people of Israel and the things that he did. Even though he came to his senses and understood what he had done and repents, I think at the end of his life, repents of the things that he had done and the choices that he had made, it was unfortunately all too late. Hugh Hefner leaves an iconic brand, one that is recognized nationally and across the world, but one that has cost America dearly for its contribution to the deconstruction of God's design for sex and sexuality. And I would ask you, if I could have a conversation with him, what matters more? Does someone's pleasure that they get to experience in life matter more than the legacy that they leave the people behind them? And the hurt, and the brokenness, and the dysfunction, and the sadness that people experience because you got to do what you wanted. Hugh is famous for having said, life is too short to be living someone else's dreams. So he lived his dream, and the country paid for it. And while we may not be to the level of someone like Hugh Hefner or King Solomon in our breadth of influence, I wonder what kind of a lesson we could take from someone like a King Solomon or Hugh Hefner. Because all of us have a choice at some point. Do we follow what we would want to follow in the world that we live in? Do we seek after all of these interests that we can have, all of the hobbies, all of the passions and all the things that the world has to offer? Or do we recognize our life in the span of eternity and the fact that what we do today has a bearing on what someone else experiences tomorrow? And the legacy that we leave for our family is more important than what we got to experience today or tomorrow or next week or next year. And sometimes it's hard because we get so blindsided by what's going on around us and we have tunnel vision and we think this is it and we don't see outside of the grander scheme of life to our children, to our grandchildren, and some of the things that they will experience, good and bad, as a result of the decisions that we make or don't make in our lives. Fortunately, King Solomon understood that at the end of his life. He was a successful king, financially, militarily, probably the best as far as success goes that Israel ever had. But the nation immediately after him divided and continued its slow decline into an eventual captivity and destruction. But there was one man who came and left a different legacy. He's the man we get together and worship every Sunday. The Son of God, Jesus Christ, who came down from heaven and reversed every bit of success that we have in our minds of what is important in life. He had no home. He had no permanent job. No bank account, no retirement savings, no nothing. And at the end of his life, no one, except for his mother and maybe a couple of disciples, to watch as he died. And yet his death and the legacy that he leaves freed millions of people across time and culture. What kind of legacy do you want to leave? The temporary pleasures for a time and enjoying what we have for the season of life, or leaving something that someone else will enjoy and become a better person, closer to God because of it. celebrate the resurrection this morning that gave us new life. The legacy that one left because he died for an entire world to see it free from its sin. And so this morning, as we reflect on life and legacy, the passing of people from time to time, the kind of legacy we want to